This is WDIY Allentown Community Public Radio for the Lehigh Valley, with studios located at 301 Broadway in South Bethlehem. After nearly 15 years as a dream, more than 5 years as a labor of love, and thanks to the efforts of 88.1 FM's staff, board of directors, contributors, and many volunteers, WDIY now officially signs on the air and begins broadcasting as the Lehigh Valley's first local public radio station.
I'm Cokie Roberts. Congratulations, WDIY, for signing on the air. Now the Lehigh Valley has its own public radio station. On the air.
We want to thank the people of the Lehigh Valley for making community public radio happen.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air, and best wishes for a long and prosperous future.
Hi, this is Paul Willistein welcoming WDIY to the Lehigh Valley Media. Congratulations on becoming the newest NPR member station.
Hello, this is Bill Height, Mayor of the City of Allentown. Public radio is important to the citizens of Allentown, and I am proud to offer my congratulations to WDIY.
Hi, this is Kate Scuffle, Executive Director of the Theater Outlet. On behalf of all of us here at the Outlet, congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
Hey! DIY. DIY.
Good evening and welcome to a different kind of On the Media. It's a local edition, a special that highlights our 25th anniversary. I'm Greg Caponia, the executive director, and the goal of tonight's show will to be answer some questions that the staff and volunteers get on a very regular basis. Primarily, how did you get started at WDIY? How did this whole thing start? We've been listening for 25 years. With me tonight is our board chairperson, Cheryl Hockney, the director of operations, Neil Heaver, Rick Weaver, who will be joining the board again, and you can hear Rick every Thursday night on his Celtic show. And a little later, Charles James will join us. I'd like to remind our listeners that we are in the middle of our fall drive, so if you would like to become a member, please do so at WDIY.org. And as I often say to Neil, what's that phone number?
610-758-8810.
Say it again.
610-758-8810. See, the numbers are in there, 8810, 881.
And we thank everybody who participates, all of our members, because without you, this would not be possible. So we thank you very much for your participation and your membership. Let's start at the beginning. Well, how did this happen?
Cheryl, do you think it might be appropriate to put a little background first about Muhlenberg College's radio station?
Sure.
Then you'll have a jumping off point on that, I think. I'm class of 1982. I came to Allentown and Muhlenberg College in 1978 and was very interested in radio, having some heroes back in the New York metro area, including Dan Ingram and also Cousin Brucey. So I loved radio, and I wanted to be involved in it, and we had a station. The history of Muhlenberg College's radio station goes back to 1948, when the Science Club members pilfered a radio from a derelict Army truck that was sitting by the football field. The school had been a college during wartime for officer school, and as a result, they had some leftover equipment, and that's kind of how the club started. Then later on, they got an AM signal, 640 AM, I think it was, and then applied very early on for an FM signal, got that, but only at 10 watts. Then a power increase was requested from the FCC, and this is somewhere in the 1970s. When I came on board, it had come to its final stages.
And keep in mind, FM at the time was still kind of a foreign object.
In the 1970s, it was very out there. It was different. I was listening to it in New York City area, and it was fun. But this was for college and university-level radio stations. They got the power increase. I came in at that time, and we put the new antenna up on the Edinger building in January of 1981. It was very, very cold. But 250 watts from 10 to 250, and then that was 440 ERP, which is your effective radiated power. On top of a hill, on top of the Edinger building at Muhlenberg College, the signal blew out about 30, 35 miles. Overnight, a huge change for us. An FCC letter showed up, and I had to respond to it. It said, if you don't stay on the air 40 hours a week, Muhlenberg will lose its FM license to another party.
That's 52 weeks out of the year, right?
Yeah, that 40 hours per week, 52 weeks out of the year. You couldn't take a college vacation for the summer and go off the air for 3 months. It could not be done.
Which was done quite a bit at the time.
It was, right. But it didn't matter so much with a 10-watt station, but now we were 250. So I called our manager, Joe Sefraza, and I said, Joe, we got to stay on the air. I got this letter. What do I do? He goes, I don't know. I said, well, you know, there are some people here who are not students or are part-time students that might be able to help us out. I could put a team together. And he said, do it. The first person I spoke to was Cheryl, who was on the air as her moniker was Sally Satellite. Cheryl, you'll remember this meeting. I came in. You're in the studio. You're on the board, actually. You were running a show. And I said, we have to do 40 hours a week. We need people. You leapt up out of your chair with a notebook and a pen, and you said, well, I can call this person. We can train this person. I can get this person. And that's where Cheryl, I think, should pick up.
Cheryl?
I was introduced to and fell in love with something called community radio while I was a student at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts in the late 70s. This was a radio station that was licensed to a community entity. It wasn't affiliated with a university anymore. It wasn't part of a public television station, and it wasn't part of any religious institution. And I was hearing all kinds of amazing music that I had, some of which I was familiar with, but a whole lot that I never heard before. There was also a huge array of local news and public affairs being provided. But one of the most outstanding parts of all this is that all of this radio I was hearing was being done by people from the community. These were not paid professional, quote-unquote, DJs. They didn't have that rock jock voice. These were people speaking in normal voices, presenting music and information not readily available otherwise on the FM dial and done by your friends and neighbors. And I went, what is this? When I graduated in 1978 from Clark University, I stayed that summer in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I studied to get my FCC third-class radio telephone operator's license with restrictions. Because at that time, in order to be a board operator, to have a music program or any program on a radio station, you had to go to a federal building, and you had to pass a three-part test. And they scored you right away. I hitchhiked to Boston from Worcester, and I took the test, and I passed, and I was given an overnight show on a Saturday night, Sunday morning on WCUW. At the end of 1978, I moved back here to the Lehigh Valley, and I searched below 92 on the FM dial, which is where you find non-commercial educational radio stations. And I searched and I searched, and I could not find community radio. The closest thing I could find was WMUH. And in 79, I approached a student named Steve Kloss, and Steve said, well, you have a license? Sure. We have a slot open. You can do a program. And I named that program The Sonic Eclipse, and it was a music show. And as time went on, I got to know Neil Heaver, some of the other students, Dan McKinney. And when Muhlenberg got its power increase, at first when they were testing the signal in 1980, I kept being scheduled for shows and then being told, I'm sorry, the transmitter blew up again, don't come in. But eventually, in the summer of 81, as Neil said, there was a call to action, so to speak, and we were ready. Around that time, the FCC had also deregulated. You no longer had to hitchhike to a federal building and take a terrible test. You filled out a form. You mailed it in with $5. And as long as you were a U.S. citizen and not a convicted felon, you too could be trained to do radio. And
no
that's
more
what
Element
we did.
9.
No more dreaded Element 9, which is one of the three parts of that awful FCC test. So one thing led to another. I remembered when Neil came to me with this idea. The first person I thought of was Dave Fry. Dave Fry, many of our listeners know, is the proprietor of Godfrey Daniels on the south side of Bethlehem. At that time, Dave did a folk program on WSAN AM 1470. So I knew Dave had a third-class operator's license. So I coerced Dave in saying, would you like to do a folk show? And we got Dave, and then eventually just started training people. And then as we were broadcasting that first summer, people came to us. It was as if they thought, wow, there's someone else who likes this music. There's someone else who knows about these artists. These people were lonely, and they would call the station, And they would be amazed that there was someone else who had a connection to something that they didn't think anybody else but them had.
Give us an idea. We're social distancing, so we can't see each other, which makes doing a show like this a little bit more difficult. Cheryl, give us a feeling for the type of music that you might have been playing.
Well, I was playing a lot of punk and new wave. My name got on lists, and I would get records in the mail, and I was living at home, and my father, the postal carrier, asked my father one day if he was Mr. Satellite. But I was also mixing all that new stuff with spoken word, and I was mixing it with things people already were familiar with, and trying to make the music or the sound or the beat or something or the messaging in the lyrics match. And that was the premise of the sonic eclipse. Much like a lunar or a solar eclipse is things in the skies lining up in a special way, casting special shadows on each other, so hopefully did the pieces that I selected. I recruited everybody I knew. And remember, there was no internet. There was no email. So this was all either word of mouth on the street or people who happened to find us down on the FM dial. So what happened was we became really popular. We got a real reputation in the community. Charles James typed up our first program schedule in 1982. In 1983, we went to a 16-page program guide complete with descriptions. I went out and sold advertising for it. To pay for it, we distributed it free. And it became very clear that the community really liked what we were doing. And so it didn't seem right that we should just turn it off when it was convenient for the licensee, which was Muhlenberg College. But rightly, it was part of the communications department, and it was a student club. So we came to the realization that we should incorporate as a 501c3, which is a not-for-profit corporation, so that we could raise our own money outside of the school with the hope that one day we would build our own station. Because, again, it became very clear that we were visitors.
Yeah.
We were welcome visitors, but we were visitors.
I do remember a slightly different story at that time. We were welcome initially, and things went pretty well, and we had all kinds of programs, folk and blues and jazz, and on Saturday, we had added in a polka show, which was greeted with a little bit of concern, but later on became a good fundraiser for MUH. But then things soured a bit between what I would call the student town relationship. And that was the time that I wrote to you in 1983 in December, and you saved that letter, and I looked at it again, and I said, let's do it. You want to do it. I think I want to do it. We need to move on and incorporate and become something of our own entity. Through your ability and leadership and other people that came on board, we went in that direction. That was December of 1983. And we had our first incorporation meeting in the science building at Muhlenberg College in early 1984.
So you're making the decision that you're no longer going to continue to operate at Muhlenberg and that you need to do something different.
We had a great opening and a great opportunity offered to us from the student group, but then it became evident that we were really going in a different direction.
That was actually 1991, by the way, was the last time that we were on the air as LVCBA. Many of our volunteers and members of LVCBA, Lehigh Valley Community Broadcasters Association, did stay on and continue to do radio with Muhlenberg, which is what we wanted, because we kept saying, keep your skills fresh, because one day we're going to need you.
Right, but what I meant was is that's the time when it became evident that some effort needed to be made to move into our own entity. And the first official mailing location for the incorporation was my apartment at 136 North 15th Street in Allentown, to establish an address. Then this is where all of our folks here who pick up the baton come in.
So, Rick,
yes,
what are you listening to at the time?
I was always a folkie, and I listened to that, and I also like psychedelic. I like music. I mean, you know, I was kind of a little bit of a psychedelic cutting-edge political folk rock stuff.
Can you give an example of somebody you might have...
Well, Buffalo into? Springfield, okay. Frank Zappa. I even was into the. I was even in some of the early modern stuff from, you know, kind of early punk stuff. I was in a rock and roll band in high school. I was a humdinger folk singer in college. And in college, I did radio for 2 years at WXAC at Albright College. I was doing the play Lenny. I was a Chinese waiter, and I had two lines. And somebody, a friend of mine, came up to me and said, somebody just quit, and you could do a two-hour radio show every week for as long as you want to. And this was the beginning of my junior year. And I said, two lines for a three-week run or 2 hours? I said, okay. So I did radio for 2 years. And kind of like Neil said, just expanding my musical horizons was just phenomenal, because I would bring in people. It was a huge library. And I'd bring people into the studio, and we would just kind of lock the door and maybe participate in something illegal. And then I just set them loose in the stacks and says, bring me some interesting music. So I learned all kinds about some great jazz stuff, you know, Art Blakey. I learned about bluegrass with Doc Watson. I had friends who were really progressive at Wishbone Ash. And just all this kind of great music, and it just kind of came in. And it was really fun.
So did anybody here set the stage when they went into the studio? Did they dim the lights or do a little Venus flytrap or anything like that?
Yeah, well, we would do that. But, it was one of those things that was great because there was really no adult supervision. The physics professor was the guy with the license, and so we were all operating under his license at the time. And I don't think I ever saw him. I mean, occasionally if there was a nuts and bolt problem, he'd come down there and just, you know, and it would all be taken care of. And I loved doing it, and it was great fun. But when I left doing radio, I was going to go to dental school or med school or something like that, and then I never thought I would do radio again. Then I went to grad school at Penn and got exposed to what they were doing down there at XPN, which at that time was still a college radio station. Uh-huh. With some strong influences from the young people from the Socialist and Communist Party, which was kind of interesting at the time. And then I moved up to the Lehigh Valley. I came back from a six-month cross-country trip with my girlfriend, and we settled up in Freedons. We rented a little farmhouse there, and I used to frequent the La Belle Cuisine, which was a gourmet food shop in Allentown. It was on 9th Street at the time. And Catherine Elwell was a programmer. She was the owner of the shop. And so she was telling me all about this new radio station, and she was doing classical programming. And she told me that I should come down, and there was this big meeting being held by anybody who was interested in volunteering at the radio station. So I said, well, sure, why not? I loved radio. I never thought I'd do it again. And so me and about 30 other people sat under a tree outside the studio at Muhlenberg College, and Cheryl Hockney, Sally Satellite, held court and talked to us about community radio and what we were going to do. And so I certainly signed up. You kind of had to go through some hoops first. You got training. If you had done radio before, that kind of helped. But you also had to do some kind of entry-level shows you had to kind of prove your chops with. And one of them was Musician's Menu. And you would pick an instrument, and then you would build a whole show around this particular instrument. And I think I did one on horns, and I think I did one on strings. So I was going to the library, and I was pulling out all kinds of stuff. I was featuring from flugelhorns to the basic horns from a prehistoric man that they had remnants of, and kind of getting examples of stuff maybe from the didgeridoo, and just kind of trying to build this kind of from the beginning through up to the modern time, horns and stuff like that. And the shows were pretty well received. So I kept nagging Cheryl for a show. And she says, well, you know, you got to prove yourself, or you got when things open up. And I said, well, there are people doing two or three shows a week. You know, that's not fair. This is community radio, you know. And just about the next week, somebody blew off a show for the second time, and she called me up and said, so you want a show? Here, it's yours. And it was a morning drive time show. And it was great stuff, and that's how I got started. And then
we did the alarm clock.
Did the alarm clock.
That was a great show to do.
It was a great show because it was such a mixed bag show. You could do anything on it. And then I got into the folk programming. I was a folk program coordinator for a while. And then I actually pretty much, I think I was the second secretary of the board of directors back in like 1984. I succeeded Janet James and was involved then as a secretary and then vice president, and eventually I was the president of the board. I remember it differently that I remember talking with Michael Tedesco, who was another one of the early programmers, and I think he and Sally and I were in a bar sometime talking, and we said, man, this is just time for us to do our own thing here.
I think it all coalesced at the same time, and I just happened to also write a letter to Cheryl around that time, 1983 or so, because I think we were all moving in that direction. So using the analogy, it's passing the baton on and moving to the next step.
Once again, I'd like to invite our listeners to go to WDIY.org. Once again, WDIY.org, and make a contribution, because we are in the middle of our fund drive. And you can always call 610-758-8810. That number again, 610-758-8810. If you like the story and you'd like to continue to support us, because I think we can do this for another 25 years at least.
Yeah.
I've only been here for 2 years. You have built the foundation of a community radio station that has thrived. And I know there have been some bumpy spots along the way, but the effort that goes on here, keep in mind, these programmers are primarily all volunteers. Do you know how hard that is? How long do you prepare for a show?
Well, less than I used to. I know it used to take me a couple hours to just kind of go through my stuff. How do I want to do a show? I would kind of sample each stuff. What's the mix going to be? How does the pitch going to end? How's the rhythm going to end? You want to don't want to start contrast between the song that's before and the song that's after. You might want some kind of thematic connection, either musically or in terms of the lyrics. You know, there's a lot that goes into actually making something that is sonically pleasing to the listeners. It's not just a matter of picking a good song and then following up with another good song. You really have to build your sets, and that has to do with tempo, volume, all kinds of stuff. You know, I also try to a lot of times mix keys so you don't have a jarring change from something major to something minor, unless you're really looking to change.
And you know what? That was something that everyone involved early in the community radio effort had enough time to work out and experiment and come up with these things. So I think that that was a great starting point for us. But Cheryl has a great memory. And you were talking about other people that were involved early on, like Michael Tedesco and others. I really think that Cheryl should expand on that incorporation period.
Yeah, take us from Muhlenberg to WDIY, Cheryl.
One of the things that was interesting to me, looking back especially, I guess it wasn't very interesting at the time, it was, we were just living it, is that a lot of people thought we couldn't do what we set out to do. And part of that was because there had been another organization called PASCAL, which stood for Pennsylvania Association of Songwriters, Composers, and Lyricists. And they had announced publicly that they were going to apply for a license, and that never came to anything. And then when we also announced our intent and the public media got a hold of it, we were told by another public media entity here in the Valley that they had looked into doing the same thing, but decided that the community could not support both a television station and a radio station. And we being young and not understanding the meaning of the word no, and being really hell-bent on building a radio station, just kind of went, yeah, okay, whatever, and just forged on. It's not easy to build a radio station. I mean, it's just, it's not that easy. I mean, Neil was talking about antennas earlier with Muhlenberg. The antenna that we are using right now at WDIY is our original antenna. It was built in Germany. It was a prototype. We didn't even know if it was going to work. I mean, there were just so many stories along the way of hurdles that we had or big question marks. People in the community radio world, and there is actually a community radio world, thankfully, we would go to conferences and they'd be, you can't squeeze a frequency between 88.1 and 91.9. There's too much TV interference. You'll never get that. It was on and on and on. People saying, you know, that's probably not going to work. Or, you know, you can't do this. Or, you know, other people have said they were going to do this and they're not. They didn't do it. What makes you think you can do it? And looking back on it, I think it was just the fact that we were young, we were determined, and we just didn't know the meaning of the word no.
I'll step in here, Cheryl, and say we have updated the antenna since that time. But what you reference what you reference is the goofy machinations you have to go through to make a contour of your signal in that very sensitive area near Channel 6 television back in the day when it was broadcast TV to make it work to satisfy the FCC. So we had to jump through hoops. And the people we had early on, Charlie Loggery, and Pat Shea and Charles James and others were able to pull out some kind of technical wizardry that astounded others, saying, oh, you did it. How did you do it? That's a part of our early history that we owe those people a great debt to.
Well, Charlie Loggery in particular, because as part of our story goes, one of the hurdles we had was on the very last days of when your application to the FCC has to be public for comment. Somebody went and looked at our file and decided to use a lot of our engineering study, but put a couple of twists in it and filed a competing application, which held us up for years. Charlie came in and said, if I can find you guys another frequency, you can let that other entity have that one, and I can put you on 88.1, and it's probably going to be a better signal. So Charlie Loughery not only performed magic once, he performed it twice.
Neil, could you go into more detail about what Charlie did and how you just don't put an antenna up and start broadcasting? It's really like a puzzle, and
right,
you have to
right.
fit the signal in so your signal doesn't encroach on another person's signal, because there's a lot of frequencies out there. How did he do this?
You have to look at all kinds of factors, the power of the transmitter, the antenna type, and how it makes a form of sending that broadcast out, the location of the antenna, and you know, topography, and all these things that come into it. And then back then it was, how far can we go before we dig into the Channel 6 audio signal? And so we still had to get filters for people who had TVs that while they were trying to watch Doris Day or somebody, suddenly there's this a punk radio show coming on in the middle of their program, and put those filters in to get it to work. But if you were to look at the signal pattern, it looks like a weird amoeba.
Sometimes they look like peanuts. I mean, it's,
yeah, they look strange.
It's an art form.
It is an art form. And because of that ability to figure out how to make an antenna work that was going to distribute that signal in a way that didn't interfere with Channel 6 was the key to making it work. And that's why others had abandoned the effort.
It was actually what they called a vertically polarized signal. So the shape just didn't go out like in a big round. It was directional and vertically polarized, and kind of originally where the biggest part of the signal went up towards the slate belt area, because there was a lower population density there to interfere with the Channel 6 contour. Now, the frustrating thing with that was that this is the home of Service Electric, the first cable network in the country, and we were 95% cable saturated already, so there really wasn't much of an interference with Channel 6. It was all a political thing.
It's about time for us to take a break here. You're listening to WDIY. We will be back in a second.
Connect to WDIY with our new WDIY app. Download for free from the Apple or Google store and enjoy on the go the great music, news, and programs you love on WDIY. The easy-to-use app is where you can listen to WDIY live with our weekly music schedule, podcasts, local news and public affairs, plus connect to WDIY's social media. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to WDIY, many choices, real voices.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
And welcome back to our program. It's our 25th anniversary program, and if you're enjoying what you hear, please think about giving us a donation or becoming a new member, WDIY.org. Once again, WDIY.org. Neil, give us the number.
610-758-8810.
You are with Neil Heaver, Rick Weaver, Cheryl Hockney. I'm Greg Caponia. And joining us is Charles James.
Thank you.
Charles, you've been with the station in some form or the other since 1981?
Yes, so almost 40 years.
Why don't you help us out a little bit about how we ended up on this frequency, and let's talk a little bit about the call letters, too.
Sure. We actually applied for a different frequency, and we ended up having to move to 88.1, but the other frequency, we were challenged by two other applicants in the area for that same frequency. So we had some novel engineering we had to undertake to make this happen. And we found an engineer who was able to figure out how to shoehorn a frequency into this crowded Northeast market. And it was really kind of a new engineering solution at the time. And one of our competitors didn't really follow that approach, and so their engineering work didn't meet up to the requirements of the FCC. The other applicant also didn't meet them, but they amended their application at the last minute and perhaps even a few days late, but they were accepted and they copied our application. It turned out, so then we were both in competition and the FCC had accepted both applications. So ultimately we had to even come up with a more unique type of engineering solution. And we did that, and in doing so, we came back to the table and proposed that they keep the frequency that we originally applied for and that we would move down to the bottom of the dial. And it would make us actually easier to find, even though it had some technical challenges with it, but we ended up getting a better signal in the end.
I'd like to remind everybody listening that this is 40 years ago, and these are people who are just trying to figure out how to bring cool music to you, our listener.
And NPR News.
And NPR News. Which at the time was only really about 10 or 12 years old.
Yeah. And that was one of the selling points for the community. I mean, it was if you had a bunch of like progressive musical types, kind of shoehorn a block format that included jazz, folk, world music. And we were also kind of looking for cultural music that wasn't represented on the commercial dial at all or even the standard FM dial. You needed something to kind of unify everybody's interest and bring some money into the project. So NPR news programming was kind of an essential part of the total package to get total community buy-in for it.
NPR's original mission was to fill news deserts and to bring news to places around the country that didn't necessarily have news. So that was the original mission. Charles, musically, what did you think? Take us inside what your thoughts were.
Well, musically, we built on what we had done at the local college radio station since 1981, and we were there until 1991, and then there was a four-year gap where we were focused on building the station. But programmatically, it turned out that Jeff Chambers was our volunteer program director at the time, and he proposed a schedule that looked very similar to what we had most recently done at that college radio station. And so we had same type of programming at a say 7 to 9 p.m. time frame weeknights, and there would be folk music each one of those nights, and then jazz each night from 9 to 11, and then we had alternative music and classical music and blues. So we understood all of those, and we had people that are expertise in all those areas. So we actually were able to maintain that vision and continue that idea and that programming content and shoehorn in NPR into that schedule.
We talk about community radio. Define it for us.
Access to the airwaves doesn't mean you just give somebody a microphone because they know music, but they had to be able to present the music, understand what they were presenting, assemble a program. They had to be able to operate the equipment. So we had a 10-year history of training 400 volunteers to do just that. And so that's a key component of community radio. It tends to be more diverse musically because it brings people in from different parts of the arts community throughout whatever area that station might be in. And that's what's unique about community stations. They tend to be more diverse programmatically, particularly with regard to music.
Well, and including news and public affairs, too. A lot of times, there are a lot of voices that often don't get heard from via commercial media. And with having local news and public affairs programs, you're able to give voice to, in the 70s and 80s, we used to call it the disenfranchised. That would have been a term you would have heard at NFCB, National Federation of Community Broadcasters Association conferences. You would hear about disenfranchised groups of people who didn't have a voice, that weren't represented in commercial media. And through local news and public affairs programs, you're able to do that. You're able to give different points of view. And that was another piece, a big piece of community radio. There are many stations that have more of a local news and public affairs content versus music. Community stations vary according to their communities.
One other thing in that same vein, Cheryl, was that we actually reached out to a lot of the nonprofit arts and music organizations in Lehigh Valley that were really having a hard time getting their message out on commercial FM stations, and we became a real platform for them. And when we went on the air, they said that they saw their membership go up at least 30% in the first year we were on the air because of all the opportunities we gave them to get on the air and share their programming and their arts initiatives. So that's another one of the partners that we did in that kind of informational area.
I'd like to bring the group back to the call letters. Oftentimes when I tell people I work at WDIY, they say, wow, that's cool. How'd you get those call letters?
Well, we ran a contest in the morning call, and it was funny. Charles had to sift through a lot of the submissions, and it was funny because people were giving us suggestions for local call letters that already existed. So it was kind of funny. But again, remember, there isn't any internet where you can easily check to see if things are available or not available. It takes a lot of research. And WDIY was submitted, and I made a call. Charles did some research and wasn't sure if it was taken or not. So I called the FCC, and these are back before the days where push one if you want this and push two if you want that. I got this really helpful person on the end of the line, and she told me, well, those call letters are currently in use by a U.S. Coast Guard cutter named Good Tidings. However, they've been known to release call letters if you send them a letter of request. If you'd like, I'll give you the information and you can send a letter. And so we did. But Charles can talk a little bit about the contest winner and who submitted it and where he got the idea for WDIY.
Well, you know, do-it-yourself, he thought, represented what we had done as community radio, because we were a group of volunteers on the air creating programming. So he thought it was an appropriate set of call letters. And the person was Jim Ferrani, who actually came forward with that idea. And as Cheryl noted, a letter to Good Tidings ended up resulting in them relinquishing their call letters and giving them to us. And we were happy to go forward with it. And the other thing about those call letters is he thought it also linked up with that Peter Gabriel song, DIY. We ended up using that song when we went on the air on the very first day. It was part of our opening salvo.
What was it like the first day?
I was sitting in my apartment in Savannah listening on the telephone.
It was so exciting. Well, even before we went on the air, I remember I lived up in New Tripoli at the time, kind of at the end of the where we might get good reception, and Pat Shea called me up and says, turn on the radio because we're doing a trial broadcast to see whether you actually can hear us. And I did, and I remember just almost crying. It was just so exciting. But with the day that we went on the air, we had a bunch of programmers that we had lined up, and everybody did like an hour slot in a particular genre that we were going to be presenting that day. And I remember Charles and Brian Landers, who Charles had been the president of the board while we were going through all that process, and I think Brian was the current president. We actually had a little picture of them kind of flipping a symbolic switch on the wall to kind of turn on the radio. And then everybody kind of sat down there and did a program which kind of put together a little bit of a statement of who we were and the variety of and diversity of our programming.
Here's an interesting thing as well. About the time that we were all thinking this is time to incorporate and create a radio station, people were talking about it. I sent a letter to Cheryl. It was 10 years to the date of that time period when we were talking about bringing public radio to the Lehigh Valley that it was being tested in the Flatiron Building.
So this took 10 years.
It took a decade.
This took 10 years almost, to get on almost, the air.
Almost to the day, it took 10 years.
From concept to execution, yeah.
And one of the things I want to say, and I really applaud Neil and Charles and Rick and Jeff Chambers and all of the people, that Pat Chase, all of the folks who stood by us, 10 years is a really long, hard time to sustain a dream. You have to really, really want something. You know, we were all getting a little bit older. Some of us were starting families. And yet the passion to do this and make sure it happened never waned with these people. It's just a really long time to sustain a dream.
When you finally got it on the air, did it sound the way you wanted it to?
Yeah, I think we were satisfied with realizing our dream. I mean, we had a 10-year history of doing that 6 months a year at the college station. So we did it during all the vacation breaks. So we already had trained 400 people, and we felt like we were delivering quality programming. But by the time we went on the air at DIY, then we had a staff of three. But we still continued that schedule that was developed by volunteers. And to this day, much of that schedule still exists. I have to say one thing I thought was exciting about that day that we went on the air, and we had this giant knife switch that you might see in a Frankenstein movie.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah.
And my daughter was assisting us flipping that switch, myself and Brian Landers, and we got to turn that on, and it was followed by like a 5 or 10 minute introduction, which Julie Burstein, who's the wife of our station manager at the time, Mark Maben, she had some great skills with Apple computer and doing some editing, and she put together this whole great montage of local mayors and county executives welcoming us to the air. Also, Cokie Roberts was part of that introduction, and you know, people that were known in public radio, just a lot of voices and many voices with many things to say was one of the slogans we used back then. And another one we used was, if you build it, they will listen. And that was part of the slogan that we used to get on the air.
And in that beginning period, you had Mark Maben as manager, you had Christine Dempsey as program director, and I believe Ira Farrow was doing underwriting or sales.
Development director, right.
Development director. Mm-hmm. That was the staff of three, right?
Yes, and Ira was the first employee that we hired. And as a development director, the first thing we needed was money, so he was the first hire.
So now we have 7 employees. We have over 150 volunteers. Could each of you give me 15 seconds of what you are most proud of at WDIY, Rick?
Well, I'm proud of the fact that 25 years later, we still have the great majority of the people doing program as volunteers from the community, and that we still do a diversity of music and expanded our public affairs programming. And I'm just proud of that, the fact we're here 25 years later.
Neil?
I am proud of the effort that went on that I describe when we have our fundraisers as a baton race, where you're handing off the baton to the next person, that we're also able to bring young people as interns in here and train them, and they're doing wonderful things all around the country, that we've been able to sustain that and keep it, I think, interesting and not boring for so many years.
Cheryl?
I'm just proud that we built it. When I came back from Savannah to visit, I remember coming into the station and just touching everything, because what had been a concept was now, it was now three-dimensional. When Mark Maben took me up to the roof to see the satellite dish, that's when I broke down and cried. I am very proud of this baby we've all birthed, and I thank every single person who thought about it, who dreamt about it, who helped, and all of those listeners out there who continue to give us life.
Well, Cheryl, in sort of a Game of Thrones analogy, you are the mother of dragons. Charles?
I'm that we've been able to provide a platform for the arts over the years.
Yes.
And also, I'm proud that that particular purpose is one of 5 purposes, which includes access to the airways by volunteers, that we still maintain in our bylaws 25 years after going on the air.
I've been working alongside of you now for 2 years. It's such a pleasure to be able to join you midstream and be a part of this organization as we attempt to bring great community radio to the Lehigh Valley for at least another 25 years. And finally, we all would join in saying thank you to all of our volunteers, programmers, and of course our members and our listeners. And finally, got to give the pitch. It's our fall drive. Please go to WDIY.org. Once again, that website is WDIY.org, and hit the donate button. And Neil, give us that phone number.
That would be 610-758-8810, a number that has existed as long as the station has as well.
Once again, 610-758-8810. Thank you so much for listening. And here's another 25 years.
This is WDIY commentator Bob Cohen.
One of my precious few childhood deprivations was the lack of salad. In the Ohio and Jewish home of my upbringing, everything, meat or vegetable, had to be cooked enough to be sure it was at least doubly dead, therefore mushy. One exception, the rare presentation of lettuce, came as a wedge of iceberg, smeared with the homemade mixture of ketchup and mayonnaise my mom proudly called Russian dressing. In reaction to this salad deprivation, I have evolved into something of a salad maven, though detractors might call me a salad fuss budget, or worse. Let it be said, first of all, that one man's salad is another man's garbage. Early on in my marriage, once the honeymoon was over, we noticed a clear disagreement when it came to what constituted an acceptable salad. Using this difference in a mature and marriage-sustaining fashion, my wife and I began to refer to this as our divergent philosophies of salad. But lurking beneath the perhaps superficial variables of simplicity versus complexity are likely our very reasons for eating salad. For my wife, nutritional value reigns supreme. So what I'd call garbage, she praises as a cornucopia of vitamins, minerals, and fiber. My salad motivation is frankly hedonistic, sensual. A salad should look attractive and satisfy the taste buds and other body parts involved. A salad should not present itself as a challenge to mandibular muscularity. Chunks of anything do not belong in salads. The very concept of salad depends on its being a mixture, a blend, in which the components are just minimally identifiable by texture, color, shape, but not by flavor. When properly tossed, the blend of greens, sprouts, finely diced cucumbers and peppers in one forkful can be experienced as a single composite flavor. That's why a floret of bitter broccoli or a slice of strong onion just won't do in a recipe for my kind of salad. While my marriage has apparently survived radical differences in our philosophies of salad, others contemplating permanent unions may not be so lucky and should take heed. As part of a prenuptial trial experience, I'd advise a visit to a big salad bar like the ones at Steak and Ale or the Olive Garden. Without judgment or coaxing, observe each other's salad choices. Does your intended put pickled beets and chickpeas onto her mixed greens? Does she use the salad as an excuse to drown vegetables in some variety of mayonnaise-y liquid? Does it revolt you? And the big question, can you live without the need to convert your prospective life partner to your own philosophy of salad? Above all, you must pledge mutual consent to one condition. You promise never to serve a wedge of iceberg lettuce, with or without homemade Russian dressing, and pass it off to your kids as salad. This day and age we're living in gives cause for apprehension. With speed and new invention and things like fourth dimension. But we get a trifle weary with Mr. Einstein's theory. So we must get back to Earth at last. Relax, relieve the tension. No matter what the progress or what may yet be proved, the simple facts of life are such they cannot be removed. You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say, I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.